A dreamy quilt of fog hangs in the air. So thick is the fog that the SS Yavari appears to be floating through the sky. Up on deck, leaning against the rails of the ship, is a young South American man, Cesar Arana. Through tiny slits in the fog, he makes out a giant reddish-orange post looming off in the distance. As the ship moves closer, the post begins to transform into a soaring tower with long draping cords. It's the Golden Gate Bridge, the gateway to the Golden West. And for Cesar Arana, the gateway to another life, to another self. Soon Cesar Arana would be no more, and Carlos Castaneda would be born. But for now, at this moment, as he's nearing the bridge, there's only one thought going through his mind. Anything is possible now, anything at all. At the port of San Francisco, Cesar Arana deboards with little more than pennies in his pockets, two pieces of luggage, and his movie-made dreams of America. This is Trickster, The Many Lives of Carlos Castaneda. Chapter 2, Between Worlds. Creating a world wasn't easy, and Death Valley would be a fitting place for it all to come to an end. From the very start, the whole production had been operating under Death Watch, and the threat of the studio suddenly pulling the plug had never been far from the young director's mind. Standing out on the lunar landscape of a section of Death Valley called Artist Drive, George Lucas, his production crew, and a small mob of Jawas, hooded-robed first graders from Death Valley Elementary School, were filming additional scenes for the desert planet of Tatooine, the planet where Luke Skywalker first meets a wise old desert hermit, Obi-Wan, a character Lucas had directly modeled on another wise old desert hermit, Castaneda's Don Juan. Just a little over 30 miles away from where George Lucas filmed those scenes for Star Wars, Patricia Parton's bones would be found amongst the Panamint sand dunes of Death Valley. Detective Marston Waltweiler.
I've handled several cases over the years where a person has gone to Death Valley because of the allure with the intent of taking their own life. Usually, they would take some action and it would be a gunshot. Patricia is the only one that just intentionally walked out into the desert to die.
You know, we have found bones.
Sheriff Jeff Hollowell, who worked with Detective Waltweiler on the case.
Okay, now we know our found bones have belonged to a person that was missing, whose vehicle was recovered. The case is pretty much closed because when we recovered the bones, it wasn't enough there. I mean, we could obviously get DNA, but there wasn't enough there to determine a cause and origin of the death. So we can't say, well, it's probable suicide, it's probable homicide. We don't know. We can all theorize what we believe happened. We can never prove it.
I would like to know what happened to the other women. Obviously, these people had intentionally left, but there's no indication where they went or what happened to them after that.
You know, I've been doing this long enough that I have pretty much a good gut instinct for true crime stories, and this one's clearly very mysterious.
This is Matt Ward, a crime journalist who reported on the missing women for the local Death Valley newspaper.
We don't know the whole story here, and that there may be something much uglier at the center of it. One of the real mysteries here is, why have the bodies not been found? I just cannot fathom, after 20 years, nobody has found the remains of even one of these four other women. If they just went to a place, even if it was a secluded, remote place inside an abandoned mine or a cave, and shot themselves, then where are the bodies? All five of the missing women were to receive a portion of his estate. And within days of his death, the women all forfeited their portions of the estate. That always bothered me, because how the heck would anybody ever know if that wasn't done under duress or out and out fraudulently, and those women were killed? We're talking millions of dollars, and we both know that people in the United States get killed for a lot less money than that.
Another place to search for clues as to what exactly happened when Castaneda died and his followers suddenly vanished is the story world Castaneda constructed over the course of his 10 books. Within this world, Castaneda and the missing women lived out a parallel existence. In the next chapter, we'll begin to tell the story of how Castaneda's book world emerged into being. But first, we'll follow Castaneda as he arrives at the Graduate Department of Anthropology at UCLA. You might say that he left quite an impression on friends and classmates.
Carlos was just so special. He had this kind of aura, this magic about him. He could bring all sorts of interesting and strange things to life.
Castaneda's friend and classmate, Larry Watson.
There were a few really interesting people floating around UCLA at that time. but none of them could quite match Carlos. Not any of the professors were quite as interesting as he was. His magical personality was always on display. You couldn't be with him without seeing this, without this coming out loud and clear. I knew him long before he gained any fame and fortune. I mean, I saw him in many different guises and facets, and one of those guises was when he was just a co-graduate student in the anthropology department. I met him in March of 1962. He was just standing out there at the bottom of the steps leading up to the main campus. It was this little brown man, and he had this little fair-haired boy who was about 2 years old at the time in tow. And I was curious about that.
Though they chatted only briefly that day, Castaneda's charming affability piqued Larry's interest.
Then the very next semester, I ran into him in one of Johannes Wilbert's South American seminars. He didn't stay very long. I asked Wilbert once, I said, well, what's with this guy? He never comes to class. He says, oh, well, he's working on some kind of special project. I said, oh, really?
Intrigued, Larry was curious to learn more both about the special project and the mysterious man behind it.
Anything about him at the time was interesting to me. I wanted to know a little bit more.
In the months that followed, Larry would bump into Castaneda on campus pathways and in the hallways of Haynes Hall, home to the anthropology department. Paradoxically, Larry realized the more one got to know Castaneda, the more mysterious he seemed to be.
He liked being a man of mystery. He wanted to be elusive. He didn't want to be read by people as an open book. So you just had to fill in the blanks yourself.
One of those blanks was where Castaneda was actually from. Larry and his fellow classmates received different answers from Castaneda.
He told me he was from Mexico.
He said he was from Argentina.
He would tell me I was born in Brazil.
Larry Watson.
I once said, why don't you say something in Portuguese? And he kind of hemmed and hawed and said something, which I suppose was Portuguese. But I just thought, that's peculiar. He's growing up in Brazil, and he's really a Spanish speaker.
Larry wasn't the only one at UCLA who found Castaneda to be a lively enigma. Castaneda's friend and classmate, Carol McLean.
He was very mysterious. Nobody knew where he lived. Nobody had a telephone number for him. Nobody knew when he was going to show up on campus.
Castaneda would rarely talk about his past, but there were a few exceptions. He told his friends war stories. Friend and classmate, Beryl Bellman.
He was in the service, I guess, in Latin America, so there were some occasional stories about things like that.
Carol McLean.
He told the story of his losing a testicle in the Korean War.
Castaneda was just as reticent to talk about his personal life as he was his past, but hints of it would sometimes poke out from behind the curtain.
And then, of course, there was CJ, and he called CJ his son and used to bring him to school. I don't remember talking about it to anybody, but it was clear that Carlos was not the biological father of CJ, and so that was a mystery.
To explain away the striking difference in physical appearance, Castaneda would tell classmates that CJ took after his mother, who was Swedish.
He called her Ingrid Tulip, didn't give me her real name, but that was typical for him. He wouldn't tell me people's names, people in his other lives, so to speak.
If Castaneda was indeed married to Ingrid Tulip, there were signs that suggested that their marriage was not a traditional one. Friend and classmate, Lyle Stemmen.
Once in a while, running down the hallways of the anthropology department, there would be one or two pretty girls saying, have you seen Carlos? Do you know where Carlos is? And I can see why. He is a charming guy.
Castaneda had a preternatural ability to bottle up all that charm into a personalized smile of infinite affirmation. Carol McLean.
The picture of him in my mind, he's always smiling. I always felt that I was somebody special to him. I liked him a lot. I was very fond of Carlos. He was always upbeat. He was always in good humor when I knew him, and he joked a lot. There was nothing scary or off-putting about him. I never saw a dark side of him, ever.
Carol's warm impression of Castaneda mirrored that of Larry's, as their relationship continued to grow in closeness.
It developed very slowly, but I would say within 2 years after first meeting him, we were friends, and I felt that I had more of a real friendship with him than almost any of the other graduate students in the program. We hung out a lot. We spent a lot of time together. I can hardly ever remember a time we didn't have a good time. He liked to go to the movies. In fact, often when we get together, we go to film together. And Fellini was our particular favorite. We loved his movies. We went to see a couple of them together. He was fascinated with the characters. They all seemed to be, to Carlos' way of thinking, fractions of a larger personality. Fellini's in this case.
Castaneda, too, contained a multitude of personalities. And one of those personalities loved to spring the unexpected on the unsuspecting.
Every encounter with him was kind of an adventure, something new, something truly different. One day, we were walking down the street. He said, you know, Watson, I want to show you something. And I said, well, what is it? I said, I used to live not too far from here. And he said, oh, no, it's going to be different. And he was keeping me in suspense. And so then we come to this iconic corner of 5th and Broadway. Here you have a fast food restaurant. And we're standing there, and I'd say, well, what? And he said, look, do you see that up there? On top of the building, this huge, huge statue. And he said, that's Chicken Boy. Just looked like some typical farmer, but not with a human head. You had Chicken Boy head, grotesque-looking chicken head, staring down at people, kind of grinning, you know, in this idiotic way. And I said, yeah, I see it. And he said, okay. I have something I want to show you, though. And then he went totally crazy, swearing at Chicken Boy, taking his tongue out, calling him all sorts of terrible things, this torrential, obscene fashion, which offended people walking by. Then finally, I had to ask him, I said, why are you doing this? And he said, see, I can do anything with Chicken Boy. I could swear at him and make faces from now until doomsday. It wouldn't change anything in him because he has no ego. No ego. And people can't do that with me or with you because we're too sensitive. But I can do this with Chicken Boy. He doesn't mind. He doesn't care. He's above this. And I thought, well, yeah, that's a pretty powerful lesson. I'll never forget that. He always co-opted you into his world. And you had to kind of join this little conspiracy. It was kind of a strange contradiction. You had to give yourself up unto him, and at the same time, you had to be open to the kinds of possibilities he wanted to set in a relationship.
As Larry and Castaneda's friendship grew deeper, Larry was permitted access to hidden corners of Castaneda's life.
You know, I got a look at his private life, a rather close look, actually. And I was probably one of the few people at UCLA who entered his world in that sense. But he didn't let too many people get that close to him. He really didn't.
Larry was one of the few people Castaneda allowed over to his apartment. When Larry first entered Castaneda's apartment, he was met with a harsh economic reality.
No furniture, and a mattress for a bed, and he'd had a little kind of table that he'd set up in the living room where he did writing. And it was just very Spartan. And he drove this little Beetle, this VW Beetle that was practically falling apart. He was very hard up. He didn't have a lot of money. He was just scraping by.
While Castaneda revealed to Larry sides of his personal life that he didn't reveal to others, there were still roped off areas with curtains. Behind one of those curtains were a few young women. The exact nature of their relationship with Castaneda remained unclear. One of these women was a tall, young UCLA undergraduate named Marianne Simcoe, the first of the missing women who had come into Castaneda's life.
I used to see him walking with this big, tall girl. He used to hang around with her on campus. He was very possessive and very exclusive in his relationship with her. And he'd break appointments with me sometimes just to be with her. He was not exactly super reliable. And it really annoyed me. I don't know if I was jealous or what. And once I said something to him while we were on campus, I ran into them. I said, I thought we were going to get together for lunch today. And he said, no, we are not. I'm seeing her. And I was really quite pissed off about that. So we had a little bit of a tiff because of that. If you crossed him in a certain way, he would lose his temper.
Castaneda's go-to method for discharging his disapproval was the silent treatment.
I learned my lesson. And every time I call him on anything, he'd get infuriated with me and wouldn't speak for days on end, literally.
These breaches in Larry and Castaneda's friendship were few and far between. Once the negative spell had passed, things went right back to normal, and normal meant constantly swapping stories.
He loved to tell stories, and he also liked any stories that you might have to pass on to him. It wasn't a one-way street, although I couldn't match his storytelling. I think we all acknowledged that all of us students at NYU
rate that he was the master storyteller. You just sat in awe when he got going. And you didn't really know how to describe it or categorize it. It was like partly gossip and partly philosophy and partly this and that. He was just masterful. He just was so good. It's so funny and amusing. He was funny just telling the simplest stories about people. Just like a waitress at one of the coffee shops we used to go to. Oh, he said, did you know anything about her? Julie or whatever her name is. I said, no. Well, we got to talking. Before I know it, you know, it's all very, very interesting. She's done this, she's done that. You wouldn't think that, he would tell me. And I said, no, I wouldn't necessarily think that. But you're good at bringing out the stories, the really interesting stories of people's lives. And he said, yeah. He said, well, I am a storyteller more than anything else. You know, you can call me a student of shamanism if you like, but basically, I'm just a storyteller.
Storytelling wasn't just something that Castaneda performed spontaneously. Castaneda's ability to tell a good story took work.
For the years we knew each other, he talked a lot about how he approached things, the mechanics and the whole process.
Larry would learn that a critical part of Castaneda's storytelling process lay in prospecting.
He was the great observer. He was always watching people hiding behind corners. He always had his antennas up, looking for things, scanning things for their possibilities. And then once he learned these things, then he could share this as a story with other people. He used to follow this old librarian around, this Polish guy. The guy seemed mysterious to Carlos, and he suspected he was kind of a strange, eccentric person. I mean, he'd kind of hide and watch this guy. And he said, just this librarian guy from Poland liked to go and sniff the seats where young women had been sitting for any length of time. And Carlos caught him doing this a number of times. And he said, isn't that a great story? I mean, you know, I didn't expect to hit the jackpot, so to speak, with this. But boy, so that's observing, you know, to the nth degree, I think. That everything was grist for his mill, and it would find its way to his inaction, his performance. And that was all. That was all important for him.
When hanging out on campus, Larry and Castaneda were often joined by another classmate and friend, Angelo Aronia.
Angelo was the one person that I shared with Carlos, you might say. We formed sort of an unholy trio in Haynes Hall at that time.
Angelo Aronia.
Larry and Carlos and I, the three of us, we'd always go over to the student union to relax and have coffee and talk. We were very comfortable with each other, enjoyed being together.
Maybe we were just three misfits. I think there was kind of something a little off with all three of us, actually. And that we got together because we rather enjoyed this marginality.
To Larry's delight, Castaneda would sometimes become something akin to a shock jock when dealing with Angelo.
Carlos just loved playing off of him. Carlos was a straight man.
From a mental garage full of various story odds and ends he had acquired from his story prospecting adventures, Castaneda would assemble news stories. Many of these were designed to deliver a terrific jolt.
He was always throwing you off a little bit. He liked to throw people off. He was constantly doing that. I think he got a kick out of that. He'd see the surprise in the other person's eyes and expressions of disbelief. And I think it just made him feel so powerful and so mischievous and kind of demonic. He was a trickster. You had to be on your guard with him.
This was especially true for Angelo.
Carlos would try to provoke Angelo, saying outrageous things like, oh, this strange guy in the library was telling me that he saw you crawling around the chairs in the library and sniffing the seats where women were sitting. And then Angela would get very flustered. He says, well, that's probably your fantasy, Carlos. But he was clearly shaken by these phony observations.
Castaneda's acute powers of observation translated into a remarkable ability for reading people.
Carlos's insight into the human spirit was incomparable. He really could zero in on people. He could see their strengths, but he could all zero in right in on their weaknesses.
While Castaneda loved throwing people off with his stories, that didn't mean that he thought stories were only a form of amusement or entertainment. Far from it. For Castaneda, stories were what made reality feel real. Facts and raw data alone were meaningless.
We had this horror, both of us, of people who were going around living their lives in terms of raw data, which means they were unreflective about what was going on in their lives. Raw data is just what it is, raw data. It doesn't mean anything. You have to shape this into an aesthetic rendition. We use that term, by the way. If you know what you're doing and you work over it, raw data becomes the aesthetic rendition of experience. And if you do use it right, you can work it into something really interesting. Not necessarily always profound, but certainly always interesting.
Finding a way to aesthetically render both his life and his work into a single common project was an obsession for Castaneda, as Larry learned when Castaneda first revealed to him his secret project.
He said, I'm really interested in my research. I have this guy, Don Juan, and I've been involved with him now for several years.
How Castaneda first met Don Juan was one of Castaneda's favorite stories to share.
I had a friend, very good friend of mine, who lived in Arizona. So I went to a paying visit one summer, and I stayed with him for a long time. And then he said to me at that time, there is, however, one crony that lives somewhere around there that knows a great deal about peyote. And perhaps, you know, if we're going to talk to him, maybe we should go and look him up. So we drove around, you know, and asked for directions, and then misled us deliberately. And we wound up in some hills out there, no man's land. And by the time it's about time to go home for me, so I gave it up, you know, it's nonsense to look for this old fogey that knew a great deal about peyote. So I was about to take the bus to go home when this old man walked into the Greyhound Depot. And this friend of mine says, that's the old man. I decided that perhaps that was the man I could turn into a key informant. But how do you proceed? You see, I was inexperienced. So I decided that the only way to do would be to sell myself to him and tell him that I knew a great deal about peyote. And I told him, I says, listen, I says, I know all there is to know about peyote. Perhaps it'll be, you know, convenient for you, it'll be advantageous to you if you talk to me. But this guy stopped me by looking at me. That was weird. Just by no, there was something wrong there. Very weird. See, I'm not a mystic man, see, at all. I'm very pragmatic. And I'm not scared that easily. But how could this guy stop me just looking? That was something strange. And then he said, yes, perhaps you could come and see me sometime. You know, maybe we could talk in my house. And I came to see him over and over for a period of a year. Every time I saw him, I said, when are you going to teach me about peyote? And he would laugh, you know, discard my question. Until one day he took me up. And that was the beginning of this strange thing, this apprenticeship. Apprenticeship to his knowledge, to a system, to a way of being.
He was obsessed with Don Juan. It was clearly a major force in his life, this whole experience. That was his reason for being, I guess you could say.
I was always hearing these ongoing accounts of his adventures. And so he got kind of carried away once and said, hey, Watson, why don't you come out to Sonora with me? We go out together and you can meet Don Juan and chill out. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? I really wanted to meet this guy. And he said, well, bring some stuff. And he suggested that I pack some canned food. He knew that I'd already done field research down in South America, so he was reassured that I could tough it if I had to. I really wanted to do this. Got all my stuff together, put it in my duffel bag, and I was ready to go. We were going to leave within the week, and he was going to confirm it with me beforehand, and then he was going to pick me up in this old VW, and then we were going to go out there together. So I had a very positive expectation. But a day or so before, he had to cancel out. You know, he had some elaborate excuse. I was disappointed. It really was. I suspect he didn't want anybody there who wasn't one of his true intimates like these gals. These acolytes, these female acolytes, were obviously invited to these places.
When Larry got to know Castaneda, he was a man constantly shuttling back and forth between worlds. In the world of his secret project, the world of Don Juan, Castaneda was even willing to do things that he worried imperiled his sanity, all for the sake of a great story. A great story that could climb over the cloistered walls of academia and capture a cultural moment in time. In the next chapter, we'll follow Castaneda as his psychedelic ventures with Don Juan turn not only his story world upside down, but a whole generation, one that was coming of age in a culture of drugs.